You are listening to Within Tolerance, a podcast for machinists by machinists. I'm your host, Dylan Jackson of Protean Machining. And this week, I am very happy to welcome back Al Watmo. What's going on, Al?
Well, obviously, I've changed jobs since the last time we talked. So I'm knee deep in life at Toolpath now.
Yeah. So before we get into what Toolpath is and all the cool stuff you're working on, let's talk about the decision to move over. You know, what was going through your mind? How do you weigh out a big decision like that? Because, you know, you are, I think, a large majority of the audience's connection to Autodesk. Like, you were the guy that I always reached out to if there's anything real high level that I was like, I don't know what's going on. I'll ask Al. Like, he'll know. So I imagine that comes with a lot of trepidation of moving anywhere. So, you know, what was going through your mind? What made you decide finally to move over and all that stuff?
Oh, wow. I should have expected this would be the first question. We could spend the whole conversation on that topic, I suppose. I should try and unpack that. And it circles back a lot to what we're doing at Toolpath too, to be honest. So I'm going to start there maybe, because it's top of mind for me right now. Right now we're working on an estimating product. And for me, what you're doing with an estimating product is, as a shop, you're trying to figure out what jobs are a fit for you. And if they're a fit, can you make money doing it? And some jobs aren't a fit. And other jobs could be a fit. And then some jobs are a solid fit. And I think that same thing applies to anything in life, really. Whether it's the investors that are working with us, is this a fit? Or it's you as an individual kind of saying, where are you going? It starts with the core principle of knowing who you are and what you do, so that you know which work comes in, if that makes sense. So in terms of making the career change, I think my decision started probably a year ago of figuring out who I am and what I enjoy, because I'd started to get to this point of struggling, and it seems weird to say that. Leading Fusion, it's getting a very, very, very large number of users. I don't know if I can say the number publicly, but it's significantly large number of users. I'd say it's a phase of growth where, the user count was huge. In that struggle, somebody suggested the book Six Working Geniuses, and it like resonated with me in a way that the last time something resonated with me that well was Simon Sinek saying that with his talk on Start With Why. But this one resonated the same way, because it made everything click. And the Six Working Geniuses basically unpacks it in this way. Every work goes through six phases. In the initial phase, there's a phase of wonder. And then based on that wonder, there's a phase of invention. And then based on that phase of invention, there's a phase of discernment. So I wonder why this is like this. And then somebody says, oh, well, we could solve it this way. And then somebody else has discernment and says, nah, that's a bad idea. Or that's a great idea. And then once you figure out it's a great idea, there's a phase of galvanizing. Like, let's get people excited about this and get it moving. And then once it gets moving, it's tenacity and enablement. It's the kind of the structure to see it through. And what I was struggling with is I found myself leading the team. I was constantly kind of exhausted. And what it turns out is all of my working geniuses, and what the book describes is everybody has two working geniuses that bring them joy and energy, two working geniuses that drain them, and two working geniuses that live in the middle. And it's not that anybody's wrong. It's just we're each different. And some people derive their joy from working through tasks, and other people drive their joy from the excitement of the early phases of projects. And some people wanted to cross America in a caravan, and other people wanted to build a city where they lived, right? And it's not that one is wrong, but different people get joy from different things. And it really helped me, because I found myself trying to do a lot of the organizational work for my team, thinking I was being a good manager, holding on to the not so fun work. And then I find out that in the team I had at Autodesk, half of them actually loved that for me not so fun work. So I realized, oh, there's something seriously wrong with me here. I'm holding on to the stuff that they enjoy so that I can do stuff I don't enjoy. So that helped inside of Autodesk, but then I unpacked it a little bit more and mapped it back to the phases of bringing integrated CAM to the market. And because, sorry, I should unpack, my working geniuses were at the far left-hand side of the equation. I love the invention and the galvanizing. That's kind of where I live and get joy, and it drains me on the enablement and tenacity side. It just feels like bookwork to me. And then I looked at what we were doing with CAM. In the early days of HSM Works and the early days of Fusion, it was one of invention. I wonder if we could connect CAD and CAM together. I wonder if we could sell this at scale. Like, do we need to have a post-processor engineer go out on site every single time you sell a new seat of software? No, I don't think we do. We can do this at scale. We can solve more interesting problems, and I can spend my time making friends with people like you and John Saunders and all these guys. Like, we can do this at scale. So that was a phase of invention. And then we kind of got to this phase. Okay, we figured out how to get CAD and CAM together, but now we need all the bells and the whistles. So that's to me when the DelCAM team joined, and then later we started adding the module work stuff. And it was one of galvanizing the bigger team to work on the bigger mission now that we figured out how to scale CAD and CAM. And that now I believe Fusion's getting to a phase of one of enablement and tenacity. It's got to get all the details finished. And there's a lot of details to still finish, and nobody at Autodesk is going to say that's wrong. But for me, that was kind of exhausting. So I found, and it's not that it's bad, it's just I didn't think I was the right person for that. So it could have been that I worked through the answer of offloading that work, and I had all kinds of support at Autodesk to offload that particular bit of work. But that was kind of running through my mind of knowing who I am, where I get my joy. I know I want to retire in this industry. I love the people in the industry. So how does that line up? And then it just sort of landed on a conversation with Andy one day, and it kind of fit the, oh, this is work that suits my shop, and I can make money doing it. It's not a ground zero startup. They've established a framework and there's a business. And so it kind of fit the boxes. If that makes sense.
Totally.
I'm not going to say it was easy, but that's kind of the.
No, I wanted to ask you that because I think that, especially now as there are more and more opportunities in manufacturing for people, you know, we've steered people away for so long. I think that's going to be a problem for a lot of people. You know, you might be in a job that you're on paper should be 1,000% content with. You're like, I'm getting paid super well, and you know, technically everything is great there, but you're left feeling empty, or you're left feeling wanting more. And I think that, you know, it's important for people to hear that, like, sometimes things just don't fit. Like, it could be the best thing in the world, but it's not the best thing in the world for you. So I really appreciate you sharing that. So then let's get into what is Toolpath. I think that a lot of people have not heard of Toolpath Labs. What are you guys trying to do? What are you tackling, and how are you going about that?
Yeah, so that's the thing that really excites me about Toolpath, in terms of, like, there's a lot of parallels to what I did before, but at a kind of a new elevation. To me, what Toolpath is doing is working to automate some of the menial tasks, so as manufacturing professionals, we can start thinking about a higher order level of thinking. This one kind of clicked actually for me just before I made the decision to move. I was over at the ModuleWorks conference sitting on the automation panel, and it kind of clicked with me while I was on stage, when there was just like this fear of jobs going away with automation. And while I was sitting there answering the question, I realized that with Autopilot, it's a great example. Autopilot automated stick and rudder skills for the pilot. And many could say, well, the pilot should be so fearful, there's not a job for pilots anymore. The truth is, the pilot still has a job. There's more need for pilots than there ever was before. And the pilot's actually a navigator now. They're not thinking about stick and rudder. They're thinking about avoiding weather patterns and a higher order level of thinking, because the stick and rudder skills have been automated. And the same, I think, applies to where we're going in manufacturing. If I think about, like, the building blocks of what a CAM system is, it's kind of three things plus a post-processor and simulation engine. It's a toolpath in kernel that calculates all the toolpaths. It's a method of selecting geometry for a given toolpath. And so a user interface, and I think Fusion's done a great job building an intuitive user interface. So I can say for this geometry, I want to use this toolpath. And then it's applying manufacturing parameters, an understanding of how manufacturing happens to that. Does that make sense? It's kind of three pieces, toolpath and kernel, and then a user experience to associate geometry with a particular strategy and a set of settings for how to drive the machine based on that. If I think about toolpath, it's largely thinking about that and automating that at a higher level. So it can now look at an entire part. It can analyze that part. It can decide on geometry and start to inject manufacturing parameters into it based on best practices. So it's looking at connecting those pieces. It doesn't mean the manufacturing job goes away, which is what I love. I fundamentally believe that when you automate something, it just creates more demand because you can create it more efficiently. Used to be I was the only person in my house with a cell phone, and then I got a new one every 2 years, and then the adults in my house had one, and now my daughter has a watch and she gets a new one every 2 years. Like when we get better at automating things, it just makes things more accessible. The same is true on the other end of the spectrum. So it doesn't just apply to some Americans that want more stuff. The week before I made the decision, I was in Mexico building homes for some people that didn't have homes. So equally applies to having access to people that don't have access. So I think anytime we get worried that we're going to automate things and make jobs go away, I just think, no, we're going to create access for more people and the demand will actually go up, not down. Right. So it's exciting for me to think about now there's a need for a new set of paradigms. If we automate the stick and rudder of CAM today, and we still got a ways to go, but as we automate the sticker and rudder of CAM today, the manufacturing professional can start thinking about higher order thinking. Like when you go to a trade show, the application engineer today is usually thinking about how do they pass a part from one machine to another. And they're thinking about kind of higher order thinking. A lot of the good machinists I'm talking about are trying to figure out how to get process reliability into what they're doing and measurement on the fly. And these are the kinds of things you can start thinking about if you're not thinking about fat fingering a toolpath selection. Just like when we automated selections, you're not thinking about putting a negative instead of a positive and plowing a tool into a part. It's we're at a phase where the level of thinking is shifting up, and that's exciting for the technology, and that's exciting for bringing community that I love along the ride to do more. So it's just an exciting challenge to solve while being able to make a salary doing it.
Totally. Yeah, it's funny. This whole toolpath automation thing has kind of exposed a little hypocrisy I've found inherent in my own thinking. Like, you know, when they started introducing more robots and things, I'm the first one to say, like, well, that just moves the job up the ladder and you get more money to run, you know, multiple machines with robots now or something like that. But I didn't realize, like, I was so quick to that level of thinking because I'm a programmer, you know, high level anyway. So that had nothing to do with my job, really. Yeah. And now, like, I know the second I started seeing all these toolpath automation companies come out, there was a feeling of unease. For sure. Yeah. Like right off the bat. And then it has taken some conscious thought of like, that's not the right way to be thinking about this. It is like you said, you just, now I can program even more machines quicker and faster. And I think for quite a while, there's still going to be manual programming work to be done. Like if it yes. takes care of all my roughing and major face finishing, that's a huge lump off my plate. And then I can focus on the 3D toolpaths that I really like to dial in, or like the little things that I think make my parts versus somebody else's. But it's
exactly
definitely
right. With autopilot, it's not like the stick and rudder disappeared out of the cockpit. The pilot was still there, but the main portion of the pilot's mind share was able to be freed up to think about a higher order thing. Like I will never forget my college drafting teacher, which was the lowest grade I got in draft in college, which is funny. but I remember doing a drafting project using SolidWorks at the time and had the title block from the shop I worked at. And this guy had been let go from that shop, which is an interesting detail. But he told me that parametric solid modeling, SolidWorks, was the worst thing that ever happened to the draftsman. And to some extent, he was right if you wanted to make your career making front, top, and side views line up. But at the same time, if you wanted to expand your career into thinking about design, it was the greatest thing that ever happened, because you now have a higher level job that's actually a higher level salary. But you shouldn't diminish the fact that for some that didn't want change, it's bad. For others that thrive and change and take advantage of the opportunity to change, it's a very good thing. But with every change is an opportunity. So I don't want to diminish the fact that there's, with a change, there's likely some that don't want to adapt to the change. But I think most will have far more output and mean they have a far more exciting career.
Totally. Well, so one of the questions we got from the Patreon, James Mayette asked, best guess how long before the low to medium skill CNC programmer either needs to up their game considerably or migrate to a different career? And I think that brings up something, kind of a feeling I've had about this whole CAM automation revolution that's coming, and that it's going to eliminate this middle class of programmer. You know, you will have, I think, a lot of shops doing, you know, 2.5 axis brackets for very, very cheap, because a low skill person can automate all of this stuff and set it up and run it. And then I think there's going to be very high end 5-axis shops that are doing incredibly difficult work, but that middle class seems to me like it might fade away with all of this stuff. So what's your thought on where this is all going?
That's one to think about, because obviously I started this by saying I always want to be pushing myself. So I have a bias, and I always think that we should be pushing forward and learning more, but that's what's exciting for me personally. The low to middle skill one, I think that I'd have to start by kind of thinking through what makes them low to middle skill. Are they low to middle skill because as a software industry, we delivered shitty product and you're low skilled at understanding a complex product to pick geometry? Well, then that's a different problem, because that person might be a high skilled expert that came from the shop floor and deeply understands how to make parts, but their low skill was using complex software. For that person, I think it's exciting, because we start to shift some of the quote unquote stick and rudder skills of software and draw more on the understanding of how parts are made. So for that one, I think it's more exciting. If it's low skill, truly low skill in the sense that low skill at the keyboard and mouse and don't understand the manufacturing process, well, then that's probably where the challenge is. But I think that's far less, my intuition is that's far less likely, and there's very few programmers that are actually just a keyboard and mouse input driver. Most of them, I think, and I could be wrong, I think many came from the shop floor and they were great machinists, and they found their way into using the software side of things, and maybe that was more of a struggle. So my hope is that for those, we can empower them to do more, because there's less of a burden on being an expert in a particular piece of software.
Maybe low to middle skill is the wrong way to term it, because I see it as, at least here in Tucson, there's a lot of, I don't know if they're generational shops or just shops that are complacent. So I think it's less the potential skill level and more complacency. And I think that those are the shops that do need to be worried. You know, the last new machine they bought was a 1999 Haas, and they think that that's still the peak of innovation. And like, that's the kind of stuff that I think, those are the people that I think need to be worried about this, or maybe not worried, but galvanized by this. Like, you either need to
I think you certainly want to start thinking about where they're headed, but for a lot of this stuff is a relationship business too. If that particular shop is making parts for somebody down the street and they can continue to make them effectively and have a relationship, that's fine. I think this kind of goes back to my core belief that sometimes we say cannibals are often feared and never seen in the software industry. Autodesk still sells a lot of AutoCAD. There's a lot of industries where the incumbent didn't sort of take advantage of the massive increases in output, but it doesn't necessarily mean the last thing disappeared. If we get exponentially better at producing parts for, let's say, industrial machinery, so that it's faster to tool up and build, bring a new product to market. And then the shops that take advantage of automation to deliver that will be able to focus on that. And it doesn't necessarily mean all the old stuff, quote unquote, goes away. I'm trying to think of industries where that's happened, but yeah, it's hard to know how long it takes for the old stuff to go away. But I think sometimes I think we're overly fearful of jumping forward into the future because we think the old stuff just, quote unquote, old stuff disappears away.
Right.
I don't see that to be true.
Okay. I like that. That's a good way to look at it for sure.
Thing is, how soon should you take advantage of the opportunities that are coming? I think that's the right way to look at the problem.
Right. Right. Well, and there's that whole bell curve of adoption that, you know, depends on where you fall and where you think you fall on that for sure.
Yeah.
Chris Zappatini was asking, so what excites you most about Toolpath? What excites you most about where you're going? And were there things that weren't on the roadmap before you joined that you feel are necessary and that you're starting to add?
There's a lot of questions in there again. I'll try and thoughtfully answer them. So what excites me the most is a lot of times when we think about automation, it's driven from a perspective of how do we make that other role go away? Let's say I don't want to have to deal with the grumpy machinists. Let's automate them so they can go away. I've been really excited by this team. They're largely a software team, but they had a deep respect for the machinist and a fundamental belief that we're here to make the machinist, to make the machinist be able to create more, not make them go away, but give them superhuman powers almost is the way to think about it. But we're here to create tools to increase human productivity. And that requires building up on the skills of the people that exist today. So that's what excites me is a chance to build new technology and build it in a way that brings a community and friends that I've built relationships with along. I think a big part of a platform is, and so this goes into the roadmap thing. It's not a product thing. But I showed the team a slide today of a hammer and a frame on a wall and then somebody using a hammer to frame a house. You don't buy a tool, and what we're doing is a tool. Let's be blunt. It's a tool. You don't buy a tool to put it on a wall. You buy a tool to be productive. So I think one half of it is we need to build great technology. We need to not build a hammer, but let's say we're building a nail gun, not a hammer. But as you use a nail gun, I'm sitting in my shop right now that I've framed out and I used a nail gun for it. There's some different ways you think about using a nail gun than you think about using a hammer. Far more productive, but there's a different set of skills you need to learn to learn how to sort of be productive with that new tool that's far more automated than the hammer, but still a set of skills that you need to learn. So I think the thing that I'm driving the most is not about roadmap, but more about how do we educate the base to be more productive with new set of tools. We hope you use our tools, but I think that's as much about building a product is anything is the support you have to be successful with that tool. So yeah, the excitement was the fact that we're here to make people more productive, and the adjustment was that's not just with software, that's also with education. And some of that can be me personally just sharing what we're doing, but you'll see us grow that a lot and have a significant focus on how do we change the way we think when the tool is automated in new ways?
That's great. Yeah, I think that's something that's kind of come up with every AI tool. You know, you see people now being expert in ChatGPT prompting to get the right thing. So clearly there's
just
a whole
new tool, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's very cool. And then what about things that weren't, what are you adding or what have you added since, you know, your short time at Toolpath? Like what focuses have you narrowed?
The focuses we've narrowed, it actually still says that sort of product focused because the website still says quoting, and I guess my face isn't even on it yet. But we've narrowed from quoting to specifically estimating. We're not focused on being a MES tool right now, but we do want to manage the fortunate portion of understanding what it takes to make a part And then building the flow to work in that way as well. So I just posted a video yesterday, but now you can take your customer email that has a bunch of parts to make and email that directly into Toolpath. We can analyze the part and run the report before you've even looked at the part at all. You'll be able to see the results of it. And then we're working on having that continue to flow into Fusion. Because the point of automation, the point of having your CNC machine is it's running while you're not standing in front of it. So building out the workflow so that the automation can be running and iterating through different scenarios while you're not sitting in front of the software, the keyboard and mouse is the primary thing I've started to kind of affect, to have a smooth flow of data comes into your shop. We can analyze it. We can tell you which things are fit or not a fit for your shop before you even look at it. And then from there, it can flow into kind of think of it as an estimating system that shares its homework to start with the programming process.
Awesome. Let's see. Oh, I love Tom's question. So Tom was asking, coming into a new organization, what are the first things you're looking for and how do you establish your working model? So you were jumping into a team that was already established for a couple years. How did you go about that? How do you go about integrating yourself, but also, you know, you are CEO now, so you also get to make decisions. So how did you go about that?
Yeah, so I think that is the interesting thing, because I'm not just coming into a new organization. I'm coming into a new organization as CEO. So that's obviously something to think through. In doing that, I had lots of chats with a personal friend and mentor, Carl. And he used to always say when he joined Autodesk as a CEO, he thought it was his job to make a bunch of big decisions and ended up realizing it's his job to make a few big decisions and really set the culture. It's what I felt in my role as leading product management at Fusion. And the same here is it's primarily about culture and pushing decisions as far down in the organization as possible and empowering people to do that and help the team know that if it's a decision that there's sort of no turning back from, then I should take that decision on to protect the team from the risk of making the decision. But other than that, the focus needs to be on empowering the team to make decisions. So jumping in though, me specifically, I'd say this was my biggest worry. The team at Toolpath highly respected what I've done in the industry so far, still does. And I've, over the years at Autodesk, I built a work to have a team of direct reports that would challenge me and really appreciated that. It's another thing Carl always said, you want strong convictions loosely held. I think of it being able to clearly articulate your point of view, but be willing to have that challenged. And there's this delicate balance when you clearly articulate your point of view, especially in a position of leadership, but others might not feel comfortable challenging it. The team that I had at Autodesk got very learned that I appreciated that, but that takes time. So that's probably been the biggest fear jumping in is making sure that I'm good at clearly articulating my point of view, but also reminding the team to challenge it, especially when they see the value I bring from an industry perspective. It could be easy to not be challenged so quickly.
How do you engender that though? Because, you know, it's one thing for your boss to say, oh, I'm up for criticism, but like every boss says that even if you know that they are, you know, a total glass cannon kind of person. So like, I find that usually showing rather than telling helps people understand. So like, what do you do when you join an organization to show people that you are okay getting criticism?
I guess it's a little easier for me. Our biggest weaknesses sometimes become our strengths. I'm slightly dyslexic and my spelling's terrible. So people never know if I typed it wrong or if I actually meant it. So there's a good reason to just question, did you make a spelling mistake here? So I guess that helps a little bit. Joking with myself, thanking people when they challenge it. And then also quickly surrounding myself by people that I know will challenge me. So some of the many friends that I've built over the years, I called very quickly, to see if they'll be advisors for me and challenge me on places that I know there's a long-term muscle memory to do that. And I've asked some of them to do that publicly in front of, didn't even have to ask them, but some of them have already done that publicly in front of the internal team. And I think that helps demonstrate it. But it, to me, it's very important, especially for me, because I tend to be singular focused and sometimes stubborn. And so you want that balance of like again, clear convictions, loosely held. And for each person, I think it's different the way you kind of build that balance. I think Jeff Bezos said he just always talks last. Although sometimes I like to do what I call play the restaurant game. Let's go for Italian food. And then people are like, no, I don't want Italian food. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. So sometimes you can't always talk last. I think sometimes you have to sort of propose something and a willingness to change. So I call that the restaurant game. But
I like that.
I don't know if that answers the question.
No, I think it definitely does. I've found that like joking about your own faults definitely puts people at ease a little more.
It helps, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and none of us are perfect. We're all very imperfect beings. So I think that it's very important for people to recognize that. You know, you still might be leader, but you are not infallible.
Exactly. No, as a leader, you're there to set a culture and facilitate people that are way smarter than you. I mean, the good news is I can't write a line of code to save my life either. So I don't think my opinion matters there.
Let's see. Oh, Alex, Chief Bub, are there any future markers that might indicate AI has gone too far? What limits can't we go beyond? Are there any rules? So how are you guys handling, let's expand that topic to kind of the broader thing. There is a mass fear or unease around all these AI tools in general, large in part because a lot of them have been proving to be very inaccurate at some point. So how are you guys approaching this whole AI problem so that you are still giving us the controls we need? You're kind of setting aside all that unease or trying to set it aside. Like, how are you guys handling the AI problem, quote unquote?
So I'm getting into technical territory now that is a little bit above my head, but I can explain it in broad strokes. But largely the way we're going about using AI and machine learning, the technology is largely reinforcement machine learning based, not based on your data, but on a set of problems. We sort of think of it like machining a part. It's like playing a game of chess. And what the team has done very well is built a machine reinforcement learning based system that can play the game of chess, play the game of machining a part, and iterate through scenarios until it gets one that works well. So that's not actually AI based, but the AI plays a very large role in making things more efficient to throw out bad examples. So AI is I think better used, and I think the way the system's designed is helpful. Is using it more to streamline the process and throw out things that we know are bad, more so than to create the things that are good.
Right. Well, and I think it's an important distinction that like you guys haven't shoehorned a large language model into CAM.
No.
You know, it's not like you're not going to ask it, you know, how many tools do I have in my library, and it's going to tell you 40 when you have 10. Like it's the logic inconsistencies that we see in a lot of these like common day AI tools don't exist in something like Toolpath.
Yeah. So on one hand, we're not lying when we say we're using AI, but the way we're using it is not to produce the result.
Yeah, totally. Let's get into a little bit more nitty gritty about Toolpath. NYDLS30 asked budgetary pricing structure for Toolpath Labs. So, or, you know, and we can even expand this. If somebody wants to try this out, how do we go about trying it out and what is it going to cost us?
If you want to try it out, hop on the website. We're going to say that we need you to talk to a human. We may or may not just let you try it out anyway. But there's a get in touch form and we'll connect with you and we'll get you set up. In terms of pricing and packaging, I can share rough numbers of how the market works and then rough direction of where we're thinking. I suppose that's the best thing to say. Right now, the estimating product is the product we're selling. That's $7.99. That's a shop license. It's not a user license. We do think pricing should not be done around the user, but done around productivity. And my personal feeling is a user-based model doesn't align the incentives in the world of automation. If I charged you, Dylan, as a user for my automation product, I'm not very motivated to make you twice as productive. I'm more motivated to go down the street and find 10 more Dylans and turn my back on you. That's the way that a tool that's designed to just sort of work for one user should be priced. I'd much rather sell you a product, and then as you're more productive, you're very happy to pay us more. So I think it'll be centric probably more around, very, very likely around the number of machine tools you have or the classes of machine tools you have, so that we're motivated to help you be more productive and have more machines. And if you're making more parts, then I think you're happy. And I'm just as happy to double your productivity as I am go down the street and find another Dylan. So that brush strokes, that's kind of largely what we're thinking.
Right. Well, and we talked about that a little while ago, and I thought that that's such a logic loophole that I had never realized kind of existed in manufacturing, is that, you know, fiscally, most of these companies shouldn't want you to be more productive, is what that means, when they're correct. Charging you per user.
The only reason that you'd want, in a user-based model, the only reason you'd want to increase productivity is to share shift from your competitor. So the only motivation is to be marginally more productive than the competitor down the street. That's kind of the motivation. But there's not sort of an aligned motivation for, if we all triple productivity, if I double Dylan's productivity, did I half the number of seats I'm selling him? That'd be bad. I better not do that. But if I double your productivity and you got twice as many machines, I don't think you're going to care that instead of paying me $300, you're paying me $600. It's like you're doubling. And that's kind of the order we're thinking of. So I can again share rough math, and maybe all my competitors are going to listen to this and decide to change their pricing models. That said, it's kind of public knowledge. Right now, the CAM market, it's about a $2 billion market with about 2 million users. That means it's generating about $1,000 per user per year. Rough math, it's off by a little bit. Generally speaking, most shops I talk to, they have about 2.5 machines per programmer. So you'd say that it's roughly about, the CAM market today is generating roughly about $350 per spindle per year. That's kind of the way the CAM market works right now. We don't have any intention to increase the TAM of the market without increasing productivity. So I think that gives you a pretty good ballpark that if we are making about $300 a spindle, we haven't diluted the CAM market. And if we double productivity, we've done a great thing for all of us. Twice as many machines get sold, shops are making twice as many parts, and we're twice as profitable. So I think brush strokes, that's kind of, we haven't lined the dollar figures up completely, but the pricing model will be such that it doesn't dilute the current CAM market, and we're all mutually motivated to increase productivity.
Right. Well, and I think that math's really important for people to hear, because like I had never heard any of those statistics until you and I talked, and I was like, oh, I mean, the math maths, like that kind of just makes sense.
It's not crazy, and it doesn't mean that, like because the worst thing would be is we launch a product and we double productivity and then we half our sales, and then I got to come back to Dylan and say, I'm changing the game. We're changing the terms of the relationship. I need to charge you twice as much per user. And that's just like, that's messy. You need something that scales in a predictable way. Per part, I think, is like charging per text message. That doesn't seem right. So we got to find some balance.
But per part would not last long. That's for sure.
Yeah. So again, back to my initial point, even me saying this is a strong conviction, loosely held. So folks that are listening to the podcast, if I'm completely wrong, then tell me, but you understand, or at least our intent, we want to align our incentives to your incentives so that we can focus on being more productive.
Totally. The Dr. Phil experience asked, is it ITAR compliant? And then a follow-up, is it ITAR compliant? Really drive that one home here. We spoke after he asked this question. He said, well, you know, I know Al got asked that 40,000 times a day while he was at Fusion. So he just wanted to make sure that it carried over.
The problem is still real. this is one of my joys of joining a small organization, is large organizations are slower to move, and for me at the level I was at, less predictable to move. Now when I answer this question, I understand I've got nowhere to hide. Answer it kind of in the same way. It's important. It's not something that's supported now. Thankfully, Justin, our CTO, joined us from 2 decades at NASA and clearly understands security and knows the people that we need to get when that's the primary problem to solve. We have plenty of work to do on building the technology out. So when ITAR is the biggest challenge for why people aren't using the product, I can guarantee we'll solve that problem. It's not the biggest problem right now. I think it is a very large problem for the Fusion team right now. I wouldn't say it's the biggest problem for Toolpath right now, but I have clear line of sight that it's a solvable problem.
Okay.
And it's more solvable with a small organization, to be perfectly transparent.
Totally. Well, and I'll wait to bug Justin about it whenever he comes on, but I definitely want to bully somebody about it. It seems from a user standpoint that almost all of these tools are based on Amazon Web Services. They have GovCloud. Why is it so hard for everybody to switch over to this? Like it seems, I'm sure there's work to be done, but it does not seem like this insurmountable mountain to climb like many services tell us it is, you know? And so I'll wait to bully Justin about that specifically, and he can maybe talk to more about the architecture changes.
Every shop has compliance audits you have to go through. There's compliance audits in the software world for this kind of stuff. There's costs associated with it. The larger the organization and the wider spreading the number of services, the more complex it is. A smaller organization with a more confined set of services is an easier problem to solve. If you have a job shop with one machine in it, moving to a more secure building is pretty easy. If you have a large shop spanning 7 countries and you want to move it to a new centralized location, it's a lot harder.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
So I guess I'm the job shop with one machine, so it should be easier.
just digging that hole a little deeper every time.
Yeah.
Let's see. Kale Bolivia asked, how hard are you working to put real AI into toolpath generation? Meaning if he uses the same 20 tools on his Datron Neo to make 90% of the parts that they do, will the software make those 20 tools work to quote unquote best fit? So let's talk more about how Toolpath is doing what it's doing. You know, will it take his 20-tool tool library and do its best?
Yeah, so that's actually how it works right now. It's machine learning, not AI, but that doesn't matter. Most of us, I didn't really know the distinction as a machinist either before I kind of joined the company. And you might even find it confusing, and we think we have some UI stuff to do. Right now, if you upload a part to Toolpath, it'll give you a machinability score. That machinability score is actually based on the tool library that you've provided it. So two people with two different tool libraries will get a different score, and the system absolutely prioritizes the tools within your library and the presets within your library, and then goes beyond the library if necessary. I think the added bit of the confusion is if you go trial the product right now, well, there's only a sample library on the website, and it's a pretty inclusive library that does a better job of saying is the part machinable. If you use the Fusion plugin right now, which is in beta, it uses your Fusion library, and we're doing some work to make sure you can have your custom library in the current web-based product. And then that's absolutely the way it works. If you've got 20 tools, it will use those tools, and it'll tell you if the part's machinable with those tools.
Yeah. From what I've seen, the little bit I've played with it, like the biggest thing I think that it will help, and you know, I think future updates and stuff will add to that, but like being able to show an engineer directly, like, hey, these are the choices you're making that are going to make your part either impossible to machine or extremely expensive. Because, I mean, I think everyone who's listened to this has dealt with a customer who sends you an auto dimension drawing at 4 decimal places, and then they're shocked when it's a $2,000 part. And then you talk to them, and they're like, I don't care, it's a spacer. Like, everything's a clearance hole for a bolt. Like, what are you talking about? And you're like, well, you spec'd it out as plus or minus 5/10 everywhere. Like, yeah. What, you know, so
do you really need that? You just want an edge broken? And so when I say the tool is actually, it's more interesting. See, this is what's so exciting for me. The team has built amazing technology. A lot of what we have to do is build the prompt engineering on top of it to filter. So I'll give a couple examples. When I first used it, I put it in, I think it's your fault, Dylan. I put a part in and it faced it with a little half inch end mill. I'm like, oh, this is dumb. And Justin's like, no, that's the way you should do it. Cause Dylan told me. Like, oh, but I want to use a half inch face mill. So I added a half inch face mill to my library and oh, lo and behold, it worked. So it does use the, and I said, I want to use it for facing. Another example is I uploaded something, with 2/4 inch holes, one at the top of a part and one down along by a deep, steep wall. And the one hole showed red. I'm like, well, that's 1/4 inch hole. It should work. And then I realized, oh, the holder would actually collide. So the holder would collide and it can't reach that hole. So it's not just looking at the tool, it's looking at the holder as well. So it's not just like the typical DFM of diameter times depth sort of stuff. It's looking up the stack and seeing if the holder can reach in there too. So it's really interesting how much is there. There's a lot of UI work to build the experience and then a lot of talking to machinists to say, what's the level of intent you want to drive these decisions at? Because the thinking is at a higher level now. It's, for me, pretty exciting anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I love, you know, talking to Justin, like I love that it's based on real tools. Like it is not very often you'll see like, oh yeah, this is technically possible with a 100XD half inch end mill and you can reach way down there. It's like, nobody sells that tool. That's not a real tool that anybody's going to have in their tool library. So it's still not machinable. Like,
right.
Technically,
Justin,
and real.
Justin, by the way, is the CTO.
Yes.
In case we didn't, yeah.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that the work has gone in there, that it is real tools and not just technically possible. Because, you know, everything is technically machinable. Like, in this infinitely rigid world, a 100XD tool is the same as a 1XD tool, and it doesn't matter. So, yeah, it's right. Very important. So usually I would go shop news and new things here, but maybe we can talk about new things or things you're excited about coming to Toolpath. I know you've been releasing videos to show off stuff. Let's get into it. What's exciting you currently?
The current focus is obviously IMTS is coming up. That's a big time for the industry. And if we don't have something really compelling for many, many people to be using by then, obviously we missed a cool window. So a lot of the focus is around smoothing out workflows, I think predominantly trying to make it easier for people to get their data in so they can see the system responding to their data. Making the system more reliable and, we say making it fail gracefully. Many times now the system just hard fails if we can't automate it. And my perspective is you should be able to at least see the part. We should tell you everything we know, even if we haven't solved the whole problem. So that's a large portion of the focus. And then, yeah, opening up lines of communication and chatting with people like you to pressure test what we're doing. And getting to hang out with my friends again.
Yeah, it's very exciting seeing, you know, the way that you're building that side of it. I think it's fantastic that yet again you're building a place that people can give you real world objections and criticisms and all of that and taking it in stride.
So I'm not building that at all, by the way. You knew Justin before I joined. That was always their attitude. I just have the opportunity to open that door and facilitate those conversations.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that brings me then to the last three questions I ask every guest every week. First up, what did you research this week? Doesn't have to be machining related, manufacturing related, just what's been popping up in your browser.
What did I research this week? Okay, well, now that I'm CEO, I have to come up with the crazy growth projections and trying to predict where the business is going to go. So I've been researching how to appropriately model growth, sort of using some muscle memory and some other things. But how do you set predictable targets based on my understanding of the industry? Because before I was just had to build the product, and somebody else told me what we had to achieve, and now I'm the one that has to tell the team what we need to achieve for the business to be successful. So that's what I've been researching this week.
Yeah. So actually, let's get into that a little bit. You know, you went from a manager to the tip of the spear. How has that been? What's been your biggest surprise, you know, jumping in that role?
Yeah, honestly, I feel like I've been here 2 years already, which is fun. I had a lot of fear that, even though I love change, I had a lot of fear that things would be way different on this side of the fence. It turns out it hasn't been that much different. A lot of the same muscle memories apply. We did our first board meeting last week, so I was worried. I talked to investors for the first time, and I was worried. And then some of the questions were the same kind of questions I would get from, no offense to anybody at Autodesk, but sometimes you had leaders that had a background in CAD, not manufacturing. Now I have investors that have a background in something other than manufacturing. And so it's the same kind of thing of saying, not dumb it down, but how do I explain it in a way for this audience to understand it? No different. At Autodesk, the investors in the business group had the same domain address, and now it's people with a different at after their email address, but the conversations are fairly similar. So that's been exciting. Andy, who was the CEO and is now more product focused, has been just amazing in terms of helping me step into the role and helping where I've got a weakness and kind of stepping aside, maybe sometimes too much, to let me make decisions and lead things. So that's been good too. I guess I'm still a little bit in the honeymoon stage, but I see IMTS and now sort of have the honeymoon / fear stage. It's not like the business is going to crash into a wall if we don't deliver stuff at IMTS, but it's an opportunity to talk to a lot of friends and show them what we have. And I want it to be something that's really solid, and it's good now, but I think we can be a lot better by then. But again, that's no different of wanting to deliver a quality product. So there's a lot that's been very similar. And then I don't have as many meetings, so that's good. I had to make a presentation once, and that was for a board meeting, but I think maybe once a quarter I'll have to make a Google slide instead of a PowerPoint, which is super nice to use Google again.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, have you had any unexpected changes? I mean, you kind of knew that you'd have a greater responsibility and have to talk to these investors, but was there any small things that you were not expecting jumping into a CEO role?
There's been a bunch of things that have moved a lot faster than I expected. And so then the question is, well, I don't like people keeping people waiting. So how do I respond to some of the sort of the excitement around me joining? When I left, a lot of the comments that were made in places like LinkedIn and then what the Johns had their podcast, and I think it sounded like my eulogy. So that was kind of a surprise. That was unexpected. So, humblingly unexpected the amount of support I've gotten.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I told you, like, I was sad to see you leave Autodesk, because like I said, you were kind of like the go-to contact, I think, for so many people, but incredibly excited for, you know, new journeys and opportunities and all that.
Still many of friends there, by the way. So if somebody's listening and I'm your go-to contact, I'm more than happy to help facilitate a conversation. It's great terms, great friends at Autodesk. None of this was a bet against them. I didn't talk about how hard it was to leave, but kind of leaving that community of friends and coworkers, I honestly went through personal feels of like, am I abandoning my family when I do this kind of feelings? So yeah, if you want context there, nothing but love for those guys.
Awesome. Second question. What are the things you're working on to be a better person, leader, employer, what have you? None of us are perfect. We are all working on stuff. What are you working on?
Better person, leader, employer. My wife asked me the other day, You didn't tell me you were going to be getting up so early. I thought you'd be starting at 8 because there's not as much of a team in Europe, and I've been getting up at 5 because I'm excited to go to work, which is fun. Not saying I wasn't fully excited before, but it's pretty exciting to go solve this. And then I end up kind of wrapped up in it a little too much. And to be honest, the people like Justin and some of the team is in the same boat of loving what we do. And you want to keep pushing hard, but also kind of maintain a work-life balance. So I think that's the primary thing for me personally and for the team. How do we encourage the excitement to go and the drive, but also make sure that's balanced personally and for the team. This is a marathon, not a sprint, but there is a bit of a sprint as well. I'm still kind of unpacking that one.
Do you have any habits that you're starting to work on or that you found have worked in the past? Because I would imagine that this is something you've gone through at Autodesk as well. You know, being in a leadership position, I feel like it's kind of, it goes hand in hand, unfortunately, at sometimes.
Some habits sort of land on themselves. The one that's been fun for me is 16-year-old is a student driver and he needs some hours, and it's a 20-minute drive to school. So 6:30 in the morning, I hop in the car and I'm a safety driver for him. And then I get to grab a Starbucks and bring my wife coffee home before I start the day. So that's sort of a thankfully forced habit, but that's just kind of worked out.
And that sounds potentially stressful way to start your morning, but yeah, I could see it being fun too.
He's been a very good driver, except for one instance where he came in way too hot around a corner coming down a hill and almost hit another car. So, oh, don't scare me. And then I said, why didn't you slow down? He's like, well, I didn't want to bother the car behind me. It's like, no, you bother the car behind me. You slow down. See, that was the one chance where he scared me. For the most part, he's been a phenomenal driver, a better driver than me, to be honest. So,
well, that's great. I feel like things go one of two ways. It's very rare that like you find a 16-year-old that's just kind of a middling driver. Like they're either fairly good for their age or really terrible for any age. And so I'm glad to hear he's leaning on the good side.
Yeah, he's leaning. He's definitely the responsible one. He's leaning on the good side for sure.
Last question then. What is a win or lesson from this week that you want to share?
A win or lesson from this week that I want to share. Have a bit of fun. Scott leading our sales team. We did the product. I just recorded the video. We did the product where you can email the estimates directly into the system. So basically the way it works, you forward an email to Toolpath, uploads at toolpath.com. If it came from an email address that has an account, it knows how to sync it up. I'm like, well, we need to, when the dev demoed it, he cleaned out his inbox. I'm like, oh shoot, my inbox, I'm CEO. My inbox is full of stuff I can't show. I need a fictitious email. Scott's lots of fun. Scott, what name should I come up with? And she's like, oh, you should call the estimator, Esther Mater at toolpath.com. So it's like, oh, that's great. That's great. And then, and you're like, well, who's it going to come from? Cause it came from me this time, the CEO. What are we going to do on all the demos? It's like, oh, I got it. It's going to be Nemo Parts. Nemo Parts is going to send an estimate request to Esther Mater to send them to Toolpath. And we kind of joked about that, but I think it's especially because we're a company in the AI machine learning space, and it's easy to think of it as unhuman, even though we're a bunch of humans building tools to make humans more productive. So it was just a little bit of fun to have some laughs with the team and kind of share that with the community too. I think it'll be an important to articulate that's our mission. We're humans trying to make humans better. It just so happens we're using technology to help make us better. I guess totally. That's my win that I'd share. Just laugh and smile and have fun with the team you work with.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. Well, Al, one more time, tell us where we can find you, find Toolpath, all that good stuff.
You can find me on Instagram or you can email me al.whatmo@toolpath.com. If spelling my last name is confusing, then I'll confuse you more. You can email me at al@toolpath.com. That looks like ai@toolpath.com, but I thought it'd be fun to have that domain. That'll auto forward to me. Reach out anytime.
A little difficult discerning the owls from the AIs.
Yeah,
for sure.
Al Dean and I would joke for years. How many times did you get the AI joke? So I started, when I go to trade shows, I started just putting capital L, because
there you go. Well, Al, thank you so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate it. It won't be the last time. I'm sure we'll have much more to talk about, you know, in the near future as you guys flush out the program more and, you know, really get it nailed. I'm looking forward to it.
As we do it together, we're going to do it with the community. So as we make this better for all of us.
Awesome. Good to chat. Well, thank you so much. Thank you all the Patreon members who make the show possible. And I will be back next week.